looked like a, I don't know what, a military man getting it aimed right at me there. That beautiful chant, Door of My Heart, about 3 years ago, we had a young man, probably 18 or 19, who was part of the Karma Yoga program. And he'd been in the community for a week or two. And he came up, very, very sweet fellow, but came up to Davy and me and he said, you know that chant, Door of My Heart, that line in it that says, will my days fly away without seeing thee, my Lord? Said, that's harsh, man. I had to agree with him. As Master says, the wistful yearnings of the heart can be expressed in a lot of different languages. Tonight we're going to talk about relationships, and I will talk about relationships in general and then also friendship, and then Davy will talk about marriage and children. But I was reading today some of Master's lectures preparing, and he said something that I found fascinating. He said, God is both individualistic and collective consciousness, and has collective consciousness. Said, when he's beyond creation in that form, there is no other, and he is absolutely, totally content in that form. And then when he expresses creation, it's very complex with all this collective consciousness, and he's equally present in both and equally joyful in both. That's very, I don't know, kind of fun to contemplate. I had a meditation yesterday that I found very interesting, so I'm going to impose it on you. I somehow got meditating on the idea of relativity and the relationships in a kind of astronomical sense. And so I was thinking about, if you're here on Earth and you look up, and if you had binoculars and could see the space station, you would have the perception that you're fixed here, you're solid, you're steady, and that the space station is whizzing around or moving around pretty rapidly. And then if you looked farther, you'd see the moon, and it would be moving around, and it would be moving slower than the space station, but still moving around. And the sun, that we know, moves across the sky every day, and so on. But if you were on the space station, you would have a completely different perception. You would look down, you'd think, I'm steady, I'm solid, I'm fixed in space, and the Earth is spinning around quite rapidly. In fact, it spins around once every 90 minutes or so, kind of unusual thing to see. And you'd look out and you'd see the moon moving in the sky and the sun perhaps moving in the sky. If you were on the moon, you would look and you'd see that the Earth spins around and that the space station spins around it real rapidly, but you're fixed in space. You're not moving at all. And the sun is kind of moving in some kind of orbit around you, and so on. And so it goes on and on and on. Wherever you are, it seems that you are fixed in space at that point, solid, and everything else is kind of moving around in erratic or semi-erratic directions. But isn't it interesting that Master said that samadhi starts with the intuitive perception in the individual heart that it is the center of the entire universe, the entire Imperium. And so it was fun to kind of have that visualization where, according to relativity, you see that your point in space is central and everything else is in motion around it. And it's the same in our relationships. We have the sense that our perception is right, our perception is solid, And everybody else is kind of moving around in either very erratic ways or in semi-erratic ways, but they don't quite get it the way they should, the way I've gotten it. There's an amusing story from Hari Das. Some of you have heard it before, but when he and Vijay were starting the Sacramento Center, which was our first center outside of the village here, they both had quite strong wills and quite strong opinions. And a couple of years later, Hari Das, who has a lot of very good one-liners, said, "Ah, yes, Sacramento. That was when I learned that there could be two God's wills." And that's one of the keys of relationships, because in this vast imperium with all the complexity and everything going on one level, nothing's going on at all. It's all consciousness. On another level, it's just interactions of energy. But when the ego principle comes into it, then there's the center point for each of us is our ego. Ultimately, that will be transcended, but there will still be a sense of self-identity. We'll never, ever, ever lose a sense of self-identity. It may expand. It may no longer be confined to the body and personality, which is Master's definition of ego, but it will still be there. It will still be a sense of I-ness. And so that I-ness, one might say, is one of the fixed points of the whole universe. Everything else is kind of a dream, and it takes on dreamlike qualities. But when you're in the midst of the dream, it seems very real. Last night I had a dream. I don't know, is Kent here, Kent Williams? Oh, I don't see him anyway. He was in my dream. Somehow he was a test pilot, and he had this really fast-looking new prototype jet plane. And we were flying, but we were flying, you know, about 20 feet above the pavement, kind of. And I was kept thinking, you know, he was going really fast. He's going awfully fast, and I don't know quite how he's avoiding all these telephone poles and wires. And we're flying over, it's interesting how the mind can create all of these interesting things. We're flying over something where people were living on kind of islands in a big, there was a big, like, I don't know, lagoon type thing, but it went on for miles, and they lived on little islands there. And in my mind, I said, oh yeah, I know where we are now. We're in Venice. But Venice in Los Angeles, and they all live on islands. They're rich people, and they live in the lagoons. You know, in the midst of the dream, it was perfectly logical. Still is to me. I don't know about. But so in the midst of all of this complexity, where we are, where our consciousness is, seems to be the right and, if not the only, at least the best option going. And that's partly why we really, really need relationships, is because it expands our consciousness so that we can see that maybe, just maybe, there could be another God's will. There could be another reality that is just as important as mine. One time, I'm going to steal, I hope she wasn't going to use the example, but one time Devi had a dream, and in the dream she was, more than one time she's had a dream. This particular time she had a dream in which she was telling someone something, straightening them out, and another person came into the dream and said, "Devi, you know you aren't always right." And it was Nalini. Nalini said it was me. Nalini got that role in Davy's dream. And Davy said she was a little huffy and thought, well, at least I should get to be right in my own dream. Is that pretty accurate?
We'll talk later.
There's a bad joke about a man who had a horse that was misbehaving and didn't do something. The guy said, that's one, didn't do something again. And the guy said, that's two. And then the horse balked a third time and the guy shot the horse. And the wife says, what in the world are you doing? That's one. So... by my own reckoning, I'm at least two and maybe two and a half. So I have to behave myself from here on. So at any rate, trying to come back to this theme, we are in part in the relationships that we're in order to learn to expand our consciousness beyond just our own sense of I'm right and this is reality. Being in a relationship allows us the chance to do that. Now, we're also in an ascending age of Dwapara Yuga, and so now we can see being in relationship as being a valid and true spiritual path. A few centuries ago, if you wanted to be serious spiritually, you either became a monk or a nun, or where you at least had some community, some interaction, or you became a hermit where you had no interaction with, or virtually no interaction with other people. And that was seen as the model by which you could lead a spiritual life. But to be in a relationship as a householder and be serious spiritually was really not quite considered to be as valid, or at least it was second best. We're still struggling to come out of that model. Many of the ashrams in this country have struggled very, very much if they have monks or a renunciate order or swamis, they have struggled with the question of how the householders are related to in their work. And in many cases, there have been serious problems in some of the spiritual work started here because the householders are seen as second-class citizens. And in many cases, they have moved out and left the work and gone out more or less on their own because of that. We don't have that problem here at Ananda, but it could have developed in that way. But we have fought against it because we're trying to model a new way of life here at Ananda that makes it equally valid to be a monk, a nun, a householder, a renunciate householder, a married swami, and we're still having to fight a little bit common perceptions and fight for the space to say that this is a valid and true way of looking at things. I think in a century from now, that battle will be all done. Nobody will question whether you can be just as sincerely, spiritually dedicated being a householder as you can be being a monk or a nun, if the monasteries even survive that long. They're as we all know, especially you see it in Italy, but we also see it in India too. These old monasteries that have been there for, in some cases, many centuries, now have six or seven old monks or nuns or swamis in them. And they used to be filled. They used to have 200 or 300 people in them. So that form is changing. But if the form changes and we lose the sense of spiritual dedication, it would actually be a retrograde movement in the growth of spiritual consciousness. So among others on the planet, one of Ananda's missions is to show that through relationships, we can advance spiritually when relationships are done right. They are not only not something that retards spiritual growth, but they can be a great aid to spiritual growth, both for the people in those relationships and for others that they serve. And we have many, many examples of couples at Ananda who are deeply, deeply dedicated, and not only do they serve, but their relationship is of a kind of service to the world at large. And so, as I say, that's part, one of the parts of the energy that Ananda is being asked to put out. Okay, now, coming back to the question then is not whether relationships are valid spiritually, but how can they be valid? What can we do to make relationships more spiritually valid? Because not all relationships are spiritually valid. And that's why traditionally the three great, dangers, the three great attractions are gold, sex, and wine. And the reasons that those are is that they represent the lower three chakras and they represent downward flow of energy. If we think of the heart as being the central point, because that's the center of chitwa, not the physical heart, of course. I'm talking about the anahat chakra. The anahat chakra as the central point, because that is the area, the center, the location of chitwa, or as Master defined it, our primordial feeling nature. And it's really through that feeling nature that we have the greater perception of the world than through the intellect or through the senses. And so if you think of the heart as being central, the energy, the feeling nature can do, is subject, as everything in the created universe is, to the law of duality. Everything outwardly that has gone out from God's beyond creation, once he begins creation, he can only do that through the laws of duality, through the, the light and dark and up and down and all of that. And so here in the heart, if we think of that as central, then the laws of duality say that the energy, the primordial feeling energy, can either go out or it can be withdrawn in. It can either go up or it can go down. If it goes out, it pushes out through the senses and through the intellect and the mind, but it pushes out with the mass delusion that is extremely hard to overcome, the mass delusion that reality lies outside of ourselves and that our happiness is dependent upon that reality that lies outside of ourselves. Now, everything, because we're all an extension of God and an extension of God's consciousness, and as the Shankaracharya defined God as Satchitananda, existence, consciousness, and bliss, everything that goes outward is like light from a bulb that goes out and gradually gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And the farther out that light goes, the dimmer it gets. And so the more we go out, the more the energy from the heart center, the chitwa, reaches out for fulfillment in the world, the more we find that it's ineffective and it's dimmer and we get caught in that outward going energy. But it's the mass consciousness that defines the fact that outside of ourself is where we're going to find fulfillment. Master said, and I wrote down the quote of this, he said, and I quote, "The world inside you determines your happiness or unhappiness." And so it's the world inside of us that determines that happiness or unhappiness. So now we come to relationships, and the tendency in relationships is to reach outside of ourselves and to get caught into the delusion that our happiness is dependent on how that person behaves and how they relate to me. So again, we're caught in the Earth and the space station. I'm here, and according to how the movement of that space station is, or how the movement of that other person is, that makes me happy or it makes me unhappy. And it's very, very hard to overcome that delusion. The other movement of energy from the heart is either upward toward the spiritual eye or downward toward the lower chakras. Now, the chakras lower or all of them have their plus, their spiritual and contractive side, their expansive and contractive side. But the combination of the downward flow of life force with the chakras that, in a sense, represent the habitual and primordial, more animalistic nature, that can draw us more powerfully into delusion, because these lower three chakras are very, very, very powerful in their energy. The lowest one represents security and survival, chit. The next chakra up represents sexuality, reproduction. In the downward flow, in the upward flow, one, the lower chakra represents grounded, fixed ability to stay steadfast, and the next chakra represents creative flow. The third chakra represents control. In an upward flow, it's self-control. In a downward flow, it's control of others or authority issues. And so when the energy is going down and powerfully down, then those three chakras represent a kind of a trap. That's why gold, security, lowest chakra, sex, and wine. Wine, how does wine come into this? Doesn't quite seem to fit. Well, everybody, every soul instinctively knows that in order to be happy, it has to change its consciousness. So one means of changing your consciousness is through chemical, wine or drugs. But also in this sense, because this represents self-control, and when the energy is moving down, what we're actually doing is, in a sense, moving away from spiritual consciousness. Wine and drugs are used as a means of loosening self-control. Isn't that true? And so in that way, these lower three, the direction of energy in the lower three chakras can draw us into delusion. And that's why traditionally, spiritually, they have warned against it. And traditionally in monasteries, the three vows were to essentially kind of suppress the energy of the lower chakras. So poverty, chastity, and obedience. Those kind of suppress the energy or don't allow you to interact with the, one might say, natural, I don't know, I don't want to call it natural because ultimately it isn't, but it's the way nature functions with the energy of those, of securities, reproduction, and control or pecking orders or however you want to look at it. So traditionally, we have tried to stop that energy. If we're going to have good, positive spiritual relationships, we can't ignore the power of those lower chakras, because they will draw the consciousness into contraction and into a dimmer expression. We don't want, however, to suppress them. And so in our vows that we take, we don't try to suppress the energy, we try to channel it positively. And so our vows are not poverty, chastity, and obedience. They're simplicity, self-control, and cooperative obedience. Very, very different. Because Ananda is trying, Swami and Ananda and Master's teachings, we're trying to investigate a new way of working with these primordial energies. Now, the world around us is not a helpful place to carry on this investigation. I don't know of any, except for one exception, which you will recognize, but I don't know of any movie or play or book where a young man and a young woman are attracted to each other, strongly attracted to each other, but then decide that in the end they're going to found separate monasteries and seek God. You ever see a movie where that's the end of the story? Or heard a song? Or, you know, I mean, let's face it, the energy of worldly consciousness, because it is drawn into this dual flow of outward and downward energy to find its happiness. That's what worldliness means, is that you think your happiness comes through the world. That's worldliness. It's not sinning and being bad and all of that. It's just that tendency. So what we're doing is trying to work with a whole new model and set a whole new example of how to work with these energies, yet do it in the context of relationships and in the context of community together. Now, I want to move on from that, and I want to talk about how what Master talked about as the basis of all relationships should be friendship, because he said it's the purest of the relationships. And he talks a lot about friendship. I'm going to read a couple of quotes here in a moment. But next to the guru-disciple relationship, which is the deepest kind of friendship, he talks about friendship as being the basis of other proper relationships, because it is the least, has the least sense of compulsion to it. And he also says that true friendship develops over many lifetimes, that it takes a long time to develop true friendship. What do I mean by true friendship? What is virtually the first thing that he said to Swami when he accepted him? I give you my unconditional love. That is an incredible promise from anyone, but even more so from a satguru or an avatar or someone who has unified their consciousness with God, because they are speaking, they are the voice of God. So that is the voice of God saying, I give you my unconditional love. Now, of course, in a theoretical sense, God always gives us his, her unconditional love. But why is it theoretical? Because what did then Master ask? Do you also give me your unconditional love? And when Swami said yes, then That's where the deep bond took place. Now, Master said that friends who have been together for many, many lifetimes develop the ability to give each other unconditional love, but that it takes many lifetimes to do that. It has to be very selfless. You have to learn. And then in various places, but the article that I was reading today, he had a whole section on how to recognize true friends from the past that you've been with for many lifetimes. He said, one, if you come into a group and you're particularly drawn to one person, that's probably a friend. But you have to watch out, because if it's clouded by attraction or sexual attraction, then that clouds it. But if there's none of that, if there's no thinking of yourself as just kind of an automatic sense of it, he said that's a very good sign that you have known that person for a long time. He said if you meet a person and you know their inner thoughts, it's as if you can complete a sentence for them before they finish it. He said that's almost a certain sign that you have been together in the past. Now, many, many married couples, certainly Davy and I, share the ability to know what the other is thinking. In fact, we have to be careful when we're giving a talk together not to think of the stories that we want to tell, because the other person will pick them up. I probably did that with her dream. I don't know. But so as this harmony and syncopation develops between two souls, and as that has time to mature and develop deeper and deeper, a true selfless sense of friendship and support comes out. And it's on that basis that all other relationships, including marriage and business relationships and many, many others, it's on that basis of true friendship that's the foundation on which true relationships are brought. I'm going to read some quotes. Whoa, don't do that. These are quotes from Master on friendship. No matter how well you think of someone or how close you are to that person, it is important to sweeten that relationship with good manners and thoughtfulness. Then friendship becomes truly wonderful and enduring. Familiarity that leads you to be inconsiderate is very harmful to friendship. He said thoughtfulness. He told a charming story. He said he was with his guru, Sri Yukteswar, and they were talking, and Master made this statement, well, sincerity in friendship is everything. And Sri Yukteswar said, no, you're not quite right there. He said, think of this. Suppose that a dear friend of yours comes in, it's been raining outside, you haven't seen each other for some time. He comes to the house, you see each other, your sincere friendship makes you rush together and greet each other. And then you look down, and he's left his muddy boots on, and he's ruined your carpet. He said, sincerity is part of that, but wouldn't that have been nicer if thoughtfulness had entered in too? Master's so charming in his stories and examples, and of course Sri Yukteswar too. But that sense of both sincerity and thoughtfulness entering into our friendships with each other. He also said, if you mix with people with sincerity, thoughtfulness, and love, then you will attract those whom you knew before. Otherwise, you will never find your real friends. You have to be rid of all hypocrisy and insincerity and never willingly hurt anyone. Never antagonize your friends or give them cause to be angry. Never abuse or take advantage of a friend. Here's a good one. Never give counsel unless asked for. One that we could take to heart. Never give counsel unless asked for. And when you do give it, do so with sincerity and kindness, unafraid of the circumstances. Friends help each other with constructive criticism. So just a few hints on friendship. And then I want to end, then Davey will talk, and then we'll have time for questions and answers, with a few thoughts on qualities that we should develop in the relationships here at Ananda. The first is that we should try to see God not only in everyone, but as everyone. And so in our relationships with each other, really try. And it takes training of the mind, but it does develop if we work at it, to see others as God in that form, incarnate in that form. Be expansive and inclusive in our friendships. So expansive, that one danger that we have to guard against in a community, and especially such a beautiful community as this, where our friendships are on so many different levels, that we can kind of be too inclusive, exclusive in our friendships. And you hear terms like, oh, you know, the outsiders, or the world, the people that have to live in the world. A little bit of a derogatory sense coming in. We need to be very, very inclusive in our friendship, not always to the particular behaviors of people, but to the people themselves. And as we do that, as universal love begins to develop, then we truly have a relationship with the divine. Again, a story from Master and his guru. Sri Yukteswar asked Master, "Do you love everyone unconditionally?" Master said, "Yes, I do. I think I do." He said, "No, you don't. Not yet." And so Master said he was very, very open to being corrected by Sri Yukteswar. And so he thought about it and thought about it. And then his brother, his younger brother, visited the ashram. And he realized that he had a particular relationship and liked his brother, younger brother, more than he liked other people. And he realized that he was not universally, unconditionally, his love wasn't unconditional and as expansive as it should be. Then he broke through. And later on, sometime later, Sri Yukteswar said, "Do you love everyone equally?" And Master said one word, "Love." And Sri Yukteswar said, "Now you have it." And so it was just the vibration of love wasn't even individualized or directed. Always seek the highest and best for the other people that you relate to, and reinforce the upward-moving energy in them. Be very kind and non-judgmental. I'm going over my time, so I was going to read something, but read today's reading from Living Wisely, Living Well. That book is almost like the social pathway to God realization. And if we actually read and practice what's in there, it'll change us. Communicate appreciation and love to others. We had a very, very sweet letter yesterday, and it just lifted our spirits, a communication of appreciation. And then finally, I'll end with saying, use Master and Swamiji as your guides to how to carry on friendship and relationships.
Well, we started off these classes a couple of weeks ago talking about seeing Ananda, our community, as a complete yogic lifestyle. And so what I wanted to remind us of that, because what we're talking about tonight is the yogic approach to relationships, how to use our relationships to bring about union with God, not to see them as separate, but to see one as a tool, to see our relationships truly as tools to bring us closer to God. And as Dortish was talking about friendship, Master emphasizes it so much. And he really stressed, he gives all these ways to recognize friendship of other lives, as Dortish mentioned. But he says, if you recognize someone as a friend of a former lifetime, go out of your way to develop that friendship. Don't take it for granted, because that friendship can be a vehicle to bring you closer to God. So I know with people that I recognize I have deep relationships with, I really try as much as I'm able to spend time with them, because I can feel how spiritually beneficial it is for me. And one of the things that I find so inspiring, if you want to measure the spiritual growth of our community, I know when I would maybe be with some of those people in the past, the relationship would get into maybe griping or complaining or gossiping or a downward pull. And I find now at this stage in our life, of our community, when I'm with my friends, it's effortlessly uplifting. We don't have to work at it. Our consciousness just goes up and it stays there. And it's so beautiful. And you can feel the difference when you're with people that are a more superficial friendship. You know, maybe you'll talk about things that are, you know, news or activities. But when you're with your people that you're really seeing, this isn't just about hanging out together. It isn't just about having a good time and watching a movie and having whatever. This is use your friendships consciously as a vehicle to bring you closer to God. And it's one of our greatest gifts here. You know, Swamiji, a year or two ago, we were with him. And I hadn't seen him for a while, and he had been away, and I was sort of missing him. And then we got to be with him, but he didn't connect with me at all. And then as we were leaving, he called me over. He said, "Davy, I want you to know nobody is special to me. I'm not even special to me." And he was just saying, you know, feel my friendship always. And we have to learn how to do that, because Swami's friendship is extraordinary, but it will be less and less available for us on the physical plane. But just for all of us to remember, see in your friends God's gift to you, because that's what it is. God smiling at you, God comforting you, God understanding you, God accepting you as you are, even if you made a big mistake in your life. And so I really want to encourage us, balance it with this non-exclusivity that Jyotish was talking about, but don't be too busy not to go deep in your friendships, because they are a path to God. And I don't, you know, well, my father died many years ago. He died a young man. But I was so sorry I didn't get to really know him. I think perhaps it was that generation. I mean, he was in some of the horrendous battles of World War II. And now I see movies about them or documentaries about them, and I realize, gosh, my father was there. We never, ever talked about it. I never once asked him, what was it like to be in the Battle of the Bulge? What was it like to, you know, be over in Europe for 4 years, never coming back, and that, you know, and all the... and. I was so sorry I didn't go deep in that relationship, because I was a kid and you kind of take your parents for granted. But let's not take our friendships for granted, because they're not just on an emotional level. But I was talking with Dave Arshi recently, who was having some physical pain in his jaw, and he said, let's remember, and I thought it was so wonderful, he said, we're at the point of our incarnation where we're finishing up our karma. We're not making new karma. And I thought, oh, wow, that's a great idea to hold on to. But let's see our friendships like that, too. Let's wrap them up in God and give them to God. And then from, oh, let me just read this quote from Master. You know, I was, this book, for any of you, you know, I'm really saying this to a lot of our newer, younger people in the community. This book tells you, it's the Wisdom of Yogananda series, Spiritualizing Relationships. Everything you need to know about relationships is in this book. It's all master, nothing but. But relationships are an art, a spiritual discipline, and it's not about finding somebody you like. It's about you and the consciousness you bring to it. And this will be a handbook for you, if you go deep into it, that will enable you to have a fulfilling, deep relationship in God and to find really why God gave us parents and friends and spouses and children. And it's all there. But this is what Master says about friendship. When true friendship exists between two souls and they seek spiritual love and God's love together, when their only wish is to be of service to each other, their friendship produces the flame of spirit through perfected divine friendship, mutually seeking spiritual perfection, you will find the one great friend. So it's just such a gift. And from friendship, that's sort of the foundation, if you're lucky, that you can build your marriage upon. If the marriage is rooted in friendship, it will endure. If it's rooted only in emotional satisfaction, physical attraction, it can survive. But if you add that element of mutual service, respect, divine friendship, you are building a foundation that will, and upon which you can erect an edifice of God consciousness. Truly, truly, I'm not just saying this lightly. And we need, if we can see, use that as a basis in our marriages and realize that, as Jyotisha was saying earlier, we, in the beginning days of Ananda, it was hard because there were sort of a group of young people or single people who had come, and then there were people who had come basically from the world who were already married, and their marriages were not necessarily rooted in God consciousness. And so it was sort of like the renunciates versus the householders at Ananda. And there was a tension. It was not a harmonious situation at that time. And then Swamiji started the monastery, which most of you know was called Friends of God, Friendship. And most of the single people joined, not all, but most. I was one that didn't, because I think on some level of my soul, I knew that my destiny was to live the yoga of marriage. But I remember one of my very dear friends who was joining the monastery said to me, with deep concern for me, "Aren't you serious about finding God?" And I said, "Yes, but I just don't think that's my way." And it took a lot of time for the example of renunciate marriages to evolve. And I think we really are there now. There are many examples of people who are using their marriages as vehicles to find God. Period. And it's now we have, as Jatish was saying, we have renunciates, we have brahmacharis, we have married Nayaswamis, and yet beneath it all, there's the foundation of these spiritual marriages of friendship. But it's so important, particularly for those of you who are young in the community and perhaps single. I want to talk about three stages of marriages: entering into it on the right footing, continuing it and building it in God, and then finally a sense of renunciation in marriage, because each one leads to the next. So entering into the marriage, Master gives a lot of emphasis on how important it is to choose the right life partner. He said, when you meet someone, meditate on it, think about it, don't rush into it. Ask yourself the question, do I see this relationship as something that has the potential to endure for a lifetime? And if you don't waste your time. We're trying not to accrue new karma in this lifetime. We're trying to finish up our karma and move on. So I'm not saying this to you, if those of you who are single or young, because I need to say it. I'm saying it for you. I know how important it is. When I came to Ananda through God's grace, and it was only that, I lived as a single person for 7 years. I wasn't a renunciate, but I just was able to do that and not rush into something. And I know from my own personal experience that that's what gave me the ability to enter into a very deep relationship later. So I'm really, if you are in that position, we ask new people in the community to wait a year before they get in relationships. Nobody's judging you. Nobody's condemning you. Everybody has to play out their karma in the way that works for them. But we don't do it for our own benefit. We do it to help you know who you are spiritually. Because we come, our society at large, people get involved very young, and we come with the predilection to get involved with relationships on kind of a knee-jerk reaction. We're afraid to be alone. We want a companion. We're attracted to somebody. We want all the reasons. But if you can realize this isn't different from your search for God, it's part of your search for God. And if you put it in a separate box, it will be. But if you put it in the same category and with the same intensity of awareness, it will be a lever for you to motivate yourself to go forward. So Master says this about, let's see if I have the right quote. Yeah. He says about seeking a spiritual partner. Young people should consult real spiritual advisors before they marry and should be guided by long, well-tested courtship experiences. Before they marry, they should first and foremost find out whether their unity is on a soul level. Real soul marriage consists in an inborn, undying, unconditional mutual liking, which may be felt at first sight or may be the result of protracted divine companionship and courtship. In soul union, unconditional love between married couples grows deeper and deeper. There is a supernatural affinity between kindred souls. As positive and negative currents join to light an incandescent lamp, so also a perfect positive soul combined with a perfect negative, by this he means receptive soul, become fused into the light of an ever-growing love. Soul love must take the place of animal love. Soul harmony must be the spring of action in marriage. I also want to share with you, Master gives an affirmation for drawing your soul partner. And we were teaching a workshop some years ago on relationships in Assisi, and we shared this affirmation that Master, I'll give it to you in a moment, but that he suggests you do for 6 months with deep faith and intensity. And so we were sharing it, and there was a woman in the back who was, for the past 15 years that we visited Assisi, she always wants to talk with me, and it's always about she hasn't found her partner yet. And so this person raised her hand and said, "I did it, it didn't work." And I was sure to put a, you know, kind of a wet blanket on the topic, but then fortunately someone else was there who's sitting in this room now, I won't say their name. And that person said, "I did it, I had had several unhappy marriages, and I did this affirmation for 6 months, and then I did it for a year, and then I did it for several years, and then I found my soul companion." And everybody got real quiet because it was so beautiful. So this affirmation, I'll read it, but it's in this book, if you want to, in Master's Spiritual Relationships. It's, "Heavenly Father, bless me that I choose my life companion according to thy law of perfect faith and soul union." And Master says, if you do this, you will, when the time is right, you will draw the right soul companion, or, I love this, he said, you will avoid getting into a bad relationship. So you'll know. And, you know, that's something else I want to say from my own personal experience. When you're looking for a soulmate, be open. Sometimes it will be through the subtlest thing that Divine Mother's saying, no, no. Or just through a certain look in the eye where you can feel Divine Mother saying, this is the one. So look for those subtle signs, and that's how God guides us. So how do we then, for those of us who are in a marriage, how do we continue it and not let it just become commonplace or something that isn't part of our search for God? Master said, the single most important element in a successful marriage is self-control. And so I saw an advertisement for a new television show that said, it was called, I think, Whitney, and then the byline was, 50% of all marriages end in sweatpants. And what it was, you know, I had to think about that. What does that mean? And essentially what it's saying is we let down the energy. We don't care. It doesn't matter what I look like. It doesn't matter what I, you know, all of those things. And Master puts so much emphasis on the rules of married life. Keep your environment beautiful. Keep yourself well-groomed. He said that men should keep their bodies athletic so they can be like athletes. He also said you should, for a husband, one of the rules for husbands, Master's teachings are incomparable. He said you should respect your wife's friends and, if possible, like them. But that sense of self-control that you just say, where you're always trying to shoot for the highest, always trying to see God in the other person, always trying to see the highest in that other person. If they're griping or in a down mood, you don't just jump in there and wallow with them. You try to hold up the consciousness. So self-discipline, see it as an art, something you never can stop working. And what if we just every morning woke up and said, oh, hi, God, you know I love you, but I'm not going to meditate this morning. And, you know, it doesn't work. You have to do the self-discipline. And it's the same with marriage. If you just say, oh, hi, well, you know, have a good day. I really, you know, I don't really care what your plans are, and I'll see you later. Just like, how can I help you? How can I serve you during the day? What can I do that would make your life a little more uplifted or fun or functioning? And to constantly be looking, not because you're rooted in the other person, but because you see it as a path to God. how can I do this the very best that I'm capable of? And so to work in all these ways, and to also, it's important in an enduring marriage to be able to have a little distance, an inner distance. It's not like you have to be apart, but in Cahil Gibran put it so beautifully. He said, let there be spaces in your love. Let there be spaces in that love that you feel. So that, Swamiji put it so well, he said, we should be able to see God in the other person, but if there's too much familiarity and too much closeness, it becomes, the other person becomes a door rather than a window through which you can see God. So that too much closeness blocks the ability to have that quality of transcendence in the marriage. And then finally, in the last couple of years, the community has evolved to where we have Nyaswami vows for married people. And one of the wonderful, wonderful lines in the Nyaswami vows, I will never take a partner, or if I am married, I will look upon my partner as belonging only to thee, Lord. In any case, I am complete in myself, and in myself will merge all the opposites of duality. There are two important aspects of that. One, I will look upon my partner as belonging only to thee, Lord. No sense of ownership, proprietorship, as we were talking about friendship, no sense of compulsion, free, non-attached. So I will look upon my partner as belonging only to thee. In any case, I realize I am complete in myself, inner freedom, not dependency, your own strength, walking in your own truth. And in myself will merge all the opposites of duality, not falling into the delusion of masculine, feminine, I do this, you do that, you watch the cooking show, all of those things. That was for you, Cheryl. No, Cheryl, when he said that, Cheryl was saying, get back at him, get back at him. So I was waiting for the moment. Circling back and with seriousness, if we're going to find God in a marriage, we have to walk it but not be bound by it. We have to live it with depth and joy and fulfillment but not identify with it. And the freedom is what most people lose in their relationships, and that's why they cease to bring them fulfillment. Now I want to just move on to children, touch on that somewhat, and family life. And I'd like to, let's call this the yoga of family life, but I know, again, from my own experience, and the mistake that most people make in being parents is they don't do it with a sense of renunciation. They do it with a sense of identifying with the role and with the sense of ownership of the children. I'm going to read from Swamiji's book, Expansive Marriage, A Way to Self-Realization. He has such a beautiful passage on, it's about expansive child raising, and this is called God in Disguise. The wisest approach to child raising is to recognize in every child from the beginning, not a creation of our own, but a newcomer to the home, God, come to remind us of himself and of his love for us. In this way, it becomes easier to break the powerful hypnosis of delusion, again, that old I and mine, and to bring to our family life most perfectly the realization that all belongs to him. Without the respect that allows complete freedom to others, complete freedom to develop, each at his own rate and in his own way, it is impossible for people truly to expand their relationships. always there will arise the temptation to make selfish demands on one another. In the raising of children especially, it is important to remember that they are already developed souls, come into your family as guests. You have a responsibility to share with them your greater experience of life, perhaps your wisdom, certainly your love and protection, but you have no right to expect them to grow up as reflections of your personality and your ambitions. So, coming back to the yoga of friendship, marriage, and raising children, it's the same principles. We have to foster, protect, encourage our children, but with non-attachment, with the sense that they are a gift. It's very interesting having a grown child, because you look back and you realize that soul gave me the gift of living with me in that beautiful time of childhood where all the world is wonderful. And that was his gift to me. I don't own it. I couldn't hold it. He grew up. He's gone. But there was a moment in time that we shared. And if we can appreciate it in this way, we do a lot for our children, but they give us the simple gift of the wonder of childhood that we get to experience again through them. And also, in that non-attachment, sometimes it's less so in the community now, but in the past I saw the tendency to try to overprotect our children. I would hear from some of the school staff that some of the parents would say, oh, well, I don't want that child in my class because that person would be a bad influence on my children. We cannot protect our children from their karma, nor should we even try. It's a mistake to try. There's the Swami's wonderful book, Education for Life, subtitle, Preparing Children to Face Life's Challenges. Not how to avoid it, not how to circumvent it, but to face the challenges of life. That's what we need to do, not to say, oh, this world is not fraught with peril. It is fraught with peril. And they're going to fall down and bump their noses many, many times. There's nothing we can do about it. But if we can prepare them, give them through our own example, through our own modeling, to be able to deal with life's challenges, that's the best gift we can give to them. Because their karma is their own. They will have to work it out in their own way. We can't figure it out for them. I remember my mother, it was very hard for her that I came to Ananda. It was not the life she would have chosen for me. But I remember some years after being here, she sent me, again, Khalil Gibran's poem, Children, on Children. And it said, your children are not your children. They're life's longing for itself. And I was so glad that I knew by her sending me that, that she had let go. And she had found freedom from her children in her older years, later years. But if we can understand that we've been talking about these different aspects, friendship, marriage, child raising, but if we can see that there is joy in all of them, there is fulfillment, there is satisfaction, there is spiritual growth, but the bottom line really of it all is dharma, doing what's in front of us. If it's your dharma to be a brahmachari or a renunciate, if it's your dharma to be in a marriage, if it's your dharma to have children, then do it with the best that's in you. And then at the end of the day, say, at the end of each day, say, Lord, it was all yours, and I offered all back to you. And that is the yoga of relationships.
So, questions?
Questions?
Yes.
There was one part of the talk I really loved it, but I forgot what part it was. But related to my question, I when I talk to my girlfriend, I feel a certain, like, invisible bubble of energy kind of surround me, where it's kind of like this specialness, you know. And it's very, in all the relationships I've had, in both in friendships as well, all of those kind of like special relationships have been the most dualistic ones. And I feel it so distinctly, like now I'm here by myself, I pick up the phone, and all of a sudden like the bubble kind of surrounds me. It's like now you're locked into this kind of like special personal thing. And I was kind of, I've been trying to figure out for the past several weeks how to begin to transcend that specialness, because I think that, you know, when you do find your soul partner, there is that specialness, but I want to start to expand it to everyone, or just not have that encasement. I kind of feel like it's an encasement.
Did everybody hear the okay about the specialness? Well, to begin with, actually, you should try to reinforce that feeling of specialness, because that will deepen the bond and allow a kind of a soul expression between you that won't be there without a deep bond. When that bond is secure, then what you need to do is to try to feel, you were talking about a bubble around the two of you, try to feel that bubble is able to go out and include other people, but don't lose the bubble. Because if you lose the bubble, you lose the, what that bubble really is the deep, how to put it, it's the recognition of a deep relationship. And remember that your girlfriend is God, is Divine Mother, but so Divine Mother and you are having a special relationship. If you can keep that consciousness and then expand it, then you will begin to see, well, it's not just my girlfriend with which I can have that relationship, but others too. Not that you have obviously the same kind of relationship, but you have the inclusive, expansive, unconditional, impersonal love that can grow from that. But it won't grow if you don't first develop it in the smaller form.
I'll just say one quick thing in answer to it. We were married in 1975, and a few weeks before the marriage, Swamiji performed the ceremony. I started getting scared because I knew that this was something I couldn't walk away from. I knew this was going to be a formative thing in my life. And I went to Swami and I said, well, I don't want being married to kind of just cut me off, you know, make me not be open to others as well. And he said, and just what Jyotish said, he said, take the love that you feel for your partner and keep expanding it and including others in that experience. And it's not that you don't have a committed, loyal relationship, but the light that is ignited from your divine love can also touch other hearts. Okay, Ken.
In the realm of duality, this special relationship can also go the other way. A Course in Miracles distinguishes between special relationships and holy relationships, where a specialness can devolve into illusion. Can you elaborate on that?
He's saying that the Course of Miracles talks about special relationships also devolving, and holy relationships obviously would evolve. Well, of course that's true, and we've touched on that tonight about, you know, how if a relationship comes together and is special, but then the energy in that relationship either begins to head downward, then the result is going to be conflict, disharmony, and you'll feel real special about the arguments you have with your with your partner. You know, so if the energy goes downward, it will result in both parties, even though it started with let's say a special marriage is a special relationship would be a marriage. It would be rare to find the couple that comes together that is entering into that marriage that doesn't think that it's going to be forever. There is a line in a movie I remember where somebody says, oh, yes, I'm always looking for the next ex-Mrs. Johnson, whatever it is. But it's rare that people come together thinking that their relationship isn't going to last. But if habitual patterns and relationships or environment draws the energy downward, then that special relationship can devolve. Nonetheless, those people will learn something from that. So it takes, that's partly why we come back over and over and over and over again, is that we learn through experience sometimes what not to do just as much as what to do.
Okay, other questions? Don't nudge your partner. Okay, Krishna.
So you're talking about to help each other expand in that sense of being free. How do you do that?
I love questions like that. How do you do that? How do you expand that sense of being free? Encourage the other person to be as strong in themselves as they can be. Encourage them in their strengths. Support them in the highest that is within them. Don't make demands of them. You owe me this. Honor their patterns of being, their own growth. Meditate together. Very important. Serve together. Very important. Offer your relationship to God every day and thank Him for it and say, I give this to you, and if it is your will that I receive it and enjoy it for this day, then I thank you. So just don't feel like you own it. Don't be afraid of losing it. Gautama Mata said, your own will surely come to you. You cannot avoid it. So just rest in the security that God gives you these things. Enjoy them if they last a day, if they last many lifetimes. But have your goal be freedom in God.
I'll add only that referring back to what Master said about your happiness or unhappiness lies within yourself, the more we realize that and take control over our own unhappy or happy or unhappy state, the more freedom we find in ourselves. And because relationships reflect each other, the more freedom the partner will find and the more freedom comes into the relationship. So as Devi was quoting the vow, I recognize that I am complete in myself, and in myself will merge all opposites of duality. So you're complete in yourself. Your happiness is under your own control. Take control of that and then share and enjoy with somebody else. But don't be dependent.
Okay. Well.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing because I saw...
You mentioned that Yogananda in one place has really clear recommendations for husband and wife. And my wife would like to know where they are.
Okay.
Would your wife especially like to know which page the husband's recommendations are on?
Okay, Devadasi said you should read number. Do you want me to read them?
Yes.
Okay, so these are it's about 2 pages and they're not very long. This is on, it's in this book, Spiritual Relationships. It's on page 74, 5, and 6, Ideal Laws of Married Life. Plan of Behavior for Husbands. The following rule should be obeyed. You know, Jyotish wrote a book, which actually we haven't used at all tonight, which we should have, called 30 Day Essentials for Marriage. And every day it's a different thing to do. And, you know, the beautiful thing of it is when I read it, I thought, gosh, he does every single one of those except one. He said, you should dance with your partner.
Now, give him truth in advertising.
Well, once you did. And that was enough. Okay. Okay.
Neither one of us needed to repeat that experience.
Okay. Plan of behavior for the husband. The following rules, this is master, direct quote. The following rules should be obeyed by the ideal husband who wants to keep his wife loyal and loving. Number one, do not remain in the same room with your wife all the time. Do not encroach upon your wife's independence. Do not disturb your wife when she is busy with important work or personal friends. Sleep, if possible, in separate rooms. Do not insult or be sarcastic with your wife at any time. Do not argue with your wife at any time, especially before others. Go out often with her alone and frequently with your children as well, and talk with her about literature, music, and higher spiritual truths. Your life and experience with your wife must be that of daily constant progress in material, mental, and spiritual ways. Your experience with your wife must be that of increasing happiness. Keep your body like the body of an athlete. Eat raw food often, and keep your wife away from kitchen work as much as possible.
Tell them who does the dishes.
Make your home life simple and your spiritual life deep. Never lie to your wife. Never insult her parents. Study wholesome books and moral literature. Never use harsh language, but always instead use sweet language. Be chivalrous to your wife always, addressing her sweetly with dignity and attention and thanking her for her every courtesy. Remember her birthday and your wedding anniversary. Frequently offer her presents of things she needs, but not necessarily what appeals to her consciousness of luxury. Do not be jealous of your wife, nor make her life miserable with nagging. If you can't keep your wife's attention by love, nothing else will succeed in keeping it. Do not act as if you owned your wife. Help her feel that you are glad to have whatever she gives you from her soul. Give her freedom to choose her women friends. Learn to respect and, if possible, to like her friends. Live a simple, inexpensive life and inspire her to do the same. Meditate with your wife every morning and night, especially at night. Offer devotion to God by chanting or singing together. Have a little family altar where you, your wife, and your children gather to offer deep devotion to God, that your souls may be united forever in ever joyous cosmic consciousness. Now, for the wife, there's far fewer. Plan of behavior for the wife. In addition to cooperating with your husband in the ways described above, she should also follow these guidelines. Try to make him comfortable. Try to teach him self-control by love and live with him on a higher moral plane. Learn through spiritual studies. The more you meditate with him, the more he will like you. By your example, win him. Don't use force or harsh speech. Try to win him by your ideal life. Keep yourself beautiful and well-dressed, just as you were when you first met him. Never speak ill of him to your women friends. Never ridicule him or find fault with him, especially not before his children, and not even in private. Teach him only through silence and love. Never speak to him with sarcasm. Keep him busy when he is at home by reading, writing, singing, chanting, or meditating with him. Make yourself more and more useful and interesting to him. Give him the right things to eat, more raw food, fewer pastries and sweets. Food has much to do with matrimonial happiness. If your husband wanders away morally, do not nag or speak bitterly. If you happen to know of his weakness, do not cooperate with him on the physical plane until he reforms. Exercise great love and kind attention and reform him by your love. Affirm daily after meditation, Father, keep me and my husband perfectly united in body, mind, and soul, and in ever-increasing happiness by thy perfect law. Isn't that beautiful?
Okay.
It's in this book.
So Next week, is we skip a week because Davey and I will be in Los Angeles. You can come if you want, just that we won't be able to. And then the week after that, we will have a class
on renunciation. And then that will be November 10th. And then the last one will be November 17th. And that's on Life at Ananda, Finding God.
Okay, thank you all.